So tonight I wanted to talk about mindfulness in its truest form or its most known form, and that is the four foundations of mindfulness. As more of a maybe an educational talk around a system for training in meditation practice that's really quite pragmatic and I found to be very useful. Because the term mindfulness, again, is not a great term, is it? It's pretty ambiguous. What the hell is mindfulness? You know, usually people come and they're like, dude, my mind is already full, and that's the problem. I don't want mindfulness. I want the opposite. I want an empty, clear, spacious mind that's kind and accepting of all things. Right? So, you know, this term mindfulness really comes from this Pali term. The teachings of mindfulness come from a teaching in the oldest Buddhist text called Satipatthana. And Satipatthana essentially means sati. The word sati, which is the word for mindfulness, means to recognize. Some people translate it as to remember, but that's too problematic because memory associates memories. It's too subjective. So recognize, and we could even break up the word recognize and put a hyphen, recognize. So we're trying to recognize something that we've seen or that we know. We want to pay attention to something. We want to be able to recognize certain aspects of our experience. And so we want to be able to have satipatthana. Tana means a ground or a foundation. So what we want to be able to do with our mind is we want to be able to recognize that there's different aspects or qualities of experience that are available to us. And the Buddha essentially breaks those down into four. Sometimes they're called four frames of reference, which is the term I mostly think is helpful. You could also think of them as pastures of awareness. Where am I? What pasture am I grazing in? And most of us would admit pretty quickly that we graze in the thinking pasture, and we're thinking too much about everything all the time. Do you do that? Right. We like thinking. We're addicted to thinking. And, you know, thinking is not bad or wrong. Thinking gets a lot of shit done and it causes a lot of problems. So thinking is both and, right? Thinking is probably, you know, it's a tool. And it can really, you know, in my experience, it can really fuck shit up pretty quick if I'm not careful, right? So what the Buddha does is he kind of breaks it down and says, okay, yes, there's thinking, but there's other things that you could recognize. There are other aspects of your experience you could pay attention to, and that actually might be helpful to you. So mindfulness is, again, trying to bring us back into present time awareness. I wouldn't say present moment awareness. I try not to use the word moment because I don't believe there's such a thing called a moment because I have yet to be in one. So moment is really movement, again, right? The mind is moving. Experience is moving. Life is a verb, not a noun, right? Life is something that happens. It's not a place you just end up in life and you're just here hanging out. No, there's all kinds of shits going on all the time. Have you noticed? Even when you're doing nothing, you're like, I should be doing something. Someone said it to me yesterday. I said, what do you want to do today? It was a friend of ours who lives up back. She says, well, I don't want to do nothing, but I don't want to do something. I was like, I totally understand what you mean. I don't want to do something or nothing. I want to do something in the middle of those two. I basically want to lounge around all day and not feel bad about that. You ever try that? It's hard, isn't it, to just let yourself have a day and not do shit. So this present time awareness is, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at it. It's an existential framework. It's a pragmatic framework. There's a psychological framework to it. And we see, of course, that there's really no such thing as the past or the future. We're always in the present time. It's just a matter of recognizing what's happening in the present time. So the future is just thinking about later, and the past is thinking about before. But those thoughts are happening in the present time. And I don't know about you, but thinking about the past and the future, I'm kind of tired of it, frankly. And so this is the nature of anxiety and depression and all kinds of psychological challenges that we face. So the first foundation of mindfulness, I'll give you the four. The first one is there's body, there's feeling is the second foundation. The third foundation is mind states and mental attitudes, which include emotions. And the fourth foundation is thinking or mental activities, right? So we just start with the body. And so we're being asked to do in the teachings on mindfulness, the Buddha is asking us to bring attention to all these various aspects of the body. The first one, of course, is breathing. Recognizing that the body is breathing. Do you know that you're breathing in? How hard is it to recognize that? Pretty easy. You just breathe in. You go, yeah, that's happening. Big deal. What next? It's like, well, no, stay with that for a little while. Check that one out. Breathing in, breathing out. How does that feel? Can you recognize that? I mean, that's actually the pulse of life itself. The most important aspect of life is breathing. If you're not breathing, you're dying. You're dead. Right? How, you know, and how much do we take breathing for granted? So he starts with breathing. He goes through the whole body. There's a whole aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta where the Buddha brings us through 32 anatomical parts of the body, where he asks us to recognize that the body is not one thing. The body is made up of a whole system, a whole living system, a respiratory system, organ system. He even brings us to blood and pus and bile. And then actually, interestingly enough, in the list of the 32 parts, feces comes right before the brain. So the Buddha doesn't give the brain a whole lot of credit. It's like shit, brain, you know, whatever. It's just an organ. And so that might be helpful in the way that we practice like a body scan. So like when a lot of times when we do meditation practices, we move through the face and we notice, anybody notice tonight or this evening or any time in general that when you bring awareness to the body, you notice that you're holding tension in your body that you didn't notice you were holding. Maybe you're tightening your fist. Maybe your belly's tight. Your shoulder, people love the tight shoulder. So we you know, until you bring awareness and attention to that, you don't recognize that. Why? Because you're too busy thinking about what you're going to do after the class or why you came to this stupid class or whatever. All the other things you could have done tonight. But there were no good movies, so you came over here. Right? So what we try to do is we try to really recognize the body. We go through these 32 anatomical parts. There's also an aspect of the elements, fire, air, wind, water. Looking at the body in terms of elements. Activities, the body activities, walking, sitting, standing, lying down, doing dishes, going to the bathroom, actually urinating and defecating are in the Satipatthana Sutta. They're actually in the teachings on mindfulness. You know? But mostly we mindfully scroll when we're in the bathroom or read something or distract ourselves, which is no big deal, but we really a lot of times we're not interested in the body so much. We're interested in the out there in the world and objects and different things. So the body doesn't get a lot of attention unless, of course, the body is in intense pain or intense pleasure. To some degree, I think that we could say, and I've recognized that my mind kind of doesn't like my body so much. Right? The mind is like limited by the body, by birth, by old age, by sickness, by death. You know, I was recently in a motorcycle accident, as many of you know, and I was stuck in a hospital bed for 6 weeks and I couldn't get up and move. And my mind didn't like that so much. My mind was not happy with the body. This stupid broken body with its broken pelvis. Just laying here day after day eating this horrible food. Hoping somebody brings me a fucking Starbucks hot chocolate today. Which many people did because, you know, it was great, but it was also really challenging to see, wow, without the body functioning properly, the mind is really just a toilet. Just can't do much. The mind can't make a sandwich. The mind can't drive a car. The mind can't do a whole lot without the body, can it? Can't walk down the street. But we don't think of it that way. For some reason, I think as a culture, and I don't know if it's part of the human conditioning, we think that we're so impressed with the mind. But without the body, the mind, not so great. So we get it. You have a body, sure. Usually we kind of get bored with that in meditation practice. What's next? But there's a tremendous emphasis to bring awareness into the body all of the time, noticing the temperature of the body, right? Warm, cool, tired, sleepy, low energy, high energy, restless. These are aspects of the body that we're being asked to recognize, to know. And so we could sum up the body practices by saying there's sensations. We could recognize a sensation. Sound is a sensation. The five senses you learned in kindergarten are all sensations that are present in every moment. Even though when you're meditating, smell is still here. You can still smell right now. You can hear, you can taste, you can touch. But those are really trying to bring us into present time experience. Medical textbooks would call that your sensorium. That we have a sensorium of experience. We have five senses, five sense doors, which information comes in, and we have number six door. Buddhism calls number six door the mind door, the thinking door. The mind door is usually preoccupied with getting pleasure at the other five doors. Right? I'm bored, I'm going to eat something. I'm bored, I'm going to watch something. Mm-hmm. Do you do that? You recognize that? Right. Of course. And so what happens because of these sensations, what arises in the second foundation, what we're being asked to recognize is feeling, which again is a tricky term for English because it's a pretty ambiguous term. There's lots of ways one can feel. One could feel physical sensations, hot, cold. One could feel preferential feelings. I feel like Chinese, not Italian. I feel sad. I feel happy. But in the arena of Vedana, in the second foundation of mindfulness, what feeling mostly means is the impression that's created by the sensation. So the Buddha breaks it down into three basic ideas, that there's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Have you ever experienced a pleasant feeling? Do you like the pleasant feeling? I like the pleasant feeling. Pleasant feelings, so much better than unpleasant feeling, right? If I could choose, I would go with that one every single time. But that's not how it is it? We have pleasant Vedana, we have unpleasant Vedana, and we have neutral. We have feelings that are neither, which we might categorize as ordinary, or most of us, if we were honest, would probably categorize them as boring. I'm bored. I don't have a pleasant feeling to cling to. I don't have an unpleasant feeling to resist. So boring just to sit here, being neutral. Vedana, right? So we see that we can bring mindfulness to these feelings really, really quickly. It's not something that you have to think about. You don't have to be a meditation master. It's not a challenging concept for most of us to recognize pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Right? We have these feelings in the system. Our nervous system creates these. And we have pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings at all of the sense doors. Pleasant sounds, unpleasant sounds. Pleasant smells, unpleasant smells. Pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations. Pleasant things to look at, unpleasant things to look at. Right? So it's an interesting area, especially in daily life, to just notice when you are being attracted. So you're attracted to what's pleasant to see, to smell, to taste, to hear, all of that. And you're actually resistant towards what's unpleasant. It can be kind of almost fun to play that game of just being like, okay, like, what do I recognize as unpleasant, unpleasant, and neutral? And of course, you might say, well, that sounds obvious and maybe boring. Why is that important? Why is that important is because that's really what dictates our thoughts and our behaviors and our choices. That's the nature, actually, of addiction. We could say that the nature of addiction from a Buddhist perspective would be that we cling to pleasant feelings and we reject unpleasant feelings. Right? And I want to have pleasant and I want to get rid of unpleasant, and that becomes a strategy for life. And as the more I cling and the more greed and the more lust and the more craving I have towards pleasantness, often what happens is my tolerance towards unpleasant becomes less and less and less. And now I got to smoke crack because I broke my shoelace. It's like, Jesus Christ. It always happens to me. Yeah. And I've been there, I've done that. You know, it's like I can use destructive behaviors almost over any mild inconvenience. Right? And so we see in our culture, you know, that the Buddhist paradigm is actually really quite accurate in terms of this is kind of how people go, this is what we do. So we, the more mindfulness we can bring to these feelings, we can see that they dictate behaviors and thoughts, and we can have a little bit of an intervention on this. And mindfulness becomes an intervention where we can see I don't actually need to satisfy the pleasant feeling, nor do I need to resist or reject the unpleasant feeling, because I can tolerate it. Sure, it's a little warm in here, and I'm a little tired and cranky and over-caffeinated. So what? Not a problem. Right? So we see that, you know, what comes out of the body are feelings. And then when we make the shift from Vedana, feeling, and this impression, the sensations create an impression, the impression creates an attitude. And what is your attitude about unpleasant? No bueno. Don't like it. Hate it. got to get rid of it, got to fix it, got to control it. And this is where we can start to see in the third foundation of mindfulness, which is the, probably the most subtle foundation of mindfulness. It's where the mind and body kind of encounter each other. We can see that we have an attitude about whatever the feeling might be. And a lot of times this is just autopilot. We don't recognize these things. We just act. We see it, we want it, we got to have it. We see it, we don't like it, we got to get rid of it. That happens. How fast does that happen? So fast. So we see that in the teachings on the third foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha uses greed, hatred, and delusion as the functions or the qualities of mind that we want to uproot, that we want to overcome. And we see that we mostly are inclined to hatred towards unpleasant, to greed towards pleasant, and to sort of a delusion or a confusion around neutrality. Right? And so when we, and also this would include, the word that I would use is attitude is the word that I use, because I think that that for most of us is the word that we can bring most, we can bring mindfulness to our attitude probably relatively easily. Do you notice your attitude in life? Do you notice that you have attitudes about many, many different things? Have you ever recognized that you have agency over your attitude? Have you ever been able to recognize or notice or experience the fact that you can change your attitude and take responsibility for your attitude about what's happening? Which often we don't want to do because we're so busy blaming who is the creator of my shitty attitude. Right? Well, I would totally not have a bad attitude right now. If you didn't do what you did, I wouldn't feel how I feel. Right? And so that's, you know, we all do it, but, you know, how much service does that play into the quality of our life? You know, so this is really kind of a great intervention where we can start to recognize the attitude that we have. And unfortunately, the Buddhist paradigm, the Buddhist practice that we're doing really kind of encourages us and, you know, to some degree tries to get us to acknowledge that you're fully and totally responsible for your attitude. And this would include thoughts and emotions. So this is where the emotional experience comes into play. Oftentimes, I think we associate emotions with feeling. Is that true for most of us? But in the structure of the foundations of mindfulness, feeling doesn't really mean emotion. It just means the impression, the unpleasant, pleasant, neutral. And then what arises out of that is the attitude I have about that. So we could say emotions plus thoughts equals the attitude. And so if I have an emotional experience, if I feel sad, and then I start thinking about why I'm sad, and then I get caught into some narrative about how I'm a person who's sad, and then I might look around, well, who? Why am I sad? Because somebody said something that was unpleasant, and it's their fault that I'm sad. And then I have an attitude. Maybe I feel depressed, maybe I feel betrayed, maybe I feel whatever I feel. And so then that attitude oftentimes will give rise to a type of suffering, we could say, which is a strong word, or a disdain, a dislike, a dissatisfaction. And then what happens, of course, is we have these sensations and these impressions and these attitudes that usually go into what we would say in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is a very difficult to translate. The word is dhammas, which really means things, but it's also more like activities of the mind, thinking or judging, blaming, the quality of the thought, the story writing, the script making, the narrative of you and your life and why it's not going well and whose fault is it and who to blame and, you know, these types of things. Of course, I'm giving you the worst examples. It's not all bad, but you probably are familiar with some of these examples. So I like to bring them up because when we look at these kind of things and we practice attention, we can see that we can bring attention to the body and recognize that. We can bring attention to feelings and we can recognize that. We can bring attention to the attitude of mind and recognize that. And we can bring attention to the quality of the experience or the activity of thinking about that. And we can actually change or we can relate to these experiences differently because all four foundations are arising in every moment and passing in every moment. They're all there. But the way that we train is the Buddha's asking us to like spend time in each one. So that way we can have these interventions. Like I might notice that, you know, I'll be driving in my car and I'll be in traffic and I'll be late and I'll be really cranky and grumpy and like really, you ever been in that situation? And then I'll notice that and I'll be like, oh man, I'm just kind of suffering right now. I'm really having a hard time with this moment. And I'll notice and I'll be like, well, that's not helpful. I really don't want to encourage this. I don't want to pour gas on this particular fire. So I'll downshift and be like, well, what's the attitude that I have in this moment? Well, the attitude is rooted in a hatred, type of a hatred, or I would say a resistance, or probably the way that manifests most pragmatically would be like, this should not be happening right now. Have you ever had a this should not be happening right now moment? Today, 15 times, all the time. Yeah, right. So you recognize that, oh, this should not be happening. But this is happening right now. And then I'll downshift even into the foundation, like, okay, this is unpleasant. What's happening? Well, I'm gripping the steering wheel tightly, and my arm is clenched tight, and I'm, you know, and I drank too much coffee, and I'm over-caffeinated, and I didn't really eat, and I kind of forgot to brush my teeth, and I feel kind of, like, upset about that, and I'm just kind of, like, all tight in my body, and I'm not really taking deep breath. I'm just kind of trying to figure out how to get the fuck around this guy over here, you know. And then I'll be like, well, all of what I'm doing is completely unhelpful to me right now. So then you can, you know, relax the grip on the steering wheel. Take a couple breaths. Recognize that it's unpleasant. Recognize the attitude. Recognize, yes, I'm going to be late, but does that mean that, you know, they're not going to shoot me when I get there because I'm late? It's like, it's going to be okay. It's not a big deal. Right? It's just, life is like this sometimes. In that little adjustment, everything's different. Nothing's changed externally, but internally, the experience that you're having is much better than it was. You're maybe not suffering. You're probably still a little dissatisfied, and maybe you're upset that you're going to be late or whatever the case may be, but that's not such a big deal all of a sudden. Does that make sense? So you can use these sort of foundations of experience. And when you practice mindfulness, we're being asked to become pretty clear and to be able to recognize various aspects so that way we can kind of cool down. Because the mind, when the mind gets going in the fourth foundation of mindfulness and we're just really, really kind of cranking it out and really trying to figure out how I could make this different, fixing, controlling, adjusting, improving, analyzing, criticizing, negotiating, manipulating. Most of us would probably recognize that those qualities of mind are not always improving our awareness or not improving our life. Sometimes they do. But when the mind gets going that fast, what that happens is you're taking these really not great breaths. You're taking these very short, shallow breaths and getting yourself extremely worked up, which is really bad for your nervous system, which makes the body tight. So you're actually, the mind is making the body tighten and not get the oxygen that it needs. And so the more that we're able to learn how to, that's why I like the sitting practice tonight. It's so good to just practice mindfulness of breathing and relax the body because you're training your body to do that. You're training your body to, you're training your nervous system, which seems to be the big troublemaker these days, especially in the arena of PTSD and trauma, and all of these things are all about emotional dysregulation, these clinical terms, post-traumatic stress, emotional dysregulation, are all in the Vedana, they're all in the nervous system activation. And so the nervous system becomes activated and dysregulated. And we have no tolerance or capacity to hold the emotional experience. And then the mind kicks on and says, I got to fix this. And, you know, this is why we have such a huge culture of substance abuse, because if you, you know, if your nervous system is dysregulated and you snort an OxyContin and drink a bottle of vodka, your fucking nervous system will be regulated fast. You'll be all better now. Right? Alcohol is so great to regulate the nervous system. It just totally relaxes it. Right? And if we can't do it on our own, we're going to find a way to do it. So when we look at using mindfulness practice, we want to be able to train in specific ways so that way we can begin to recognize or recognize that whatever it is that we're paying attention to, there's also something else we could be paying attention to. There's always something else that happens to be true. And one of the things that I've read recently around sensory experience is that even in like somatic experience, which is a very well-respected form of trauma therapy, and also just general sensory overload that a lot of times what they'll ask you to do is, even some of these, some therapeutic places and treatment centers, especially trauma-informed ones, have these sensory rooms where there's like all these different colors and different smells and all of these different things that people use, because the five senses is what allows you to kind of bleed your awareness into what's happening right now. You know, I also read recently an article about how taking a hike and being in nature is just like super good for you, which kind of makes sense. But being able to find ways, and we're all different. This is where I think knowing your preferences and being creative is very helpful, because all of us have different sensory experiences. We're like, anybody out there love to listen to music when you're upset? Anybody ever use music as a way to emotionally regulate or discharge? Well, what is that? That's just sound, right? And so that can be very, very pleasing. Taking a walk in nature, sight, smell, hearing the sounds of the waves or the birds, all of these types of experiences, what they do is they bring your whole being into the present time experience, because all those things are happening now. That's why we like to put the earbuds on and check out. First thing I do when I get on a plane, fucking headphones go on. And I wear those big earmuff ones so the person next to me knows, don't talk to me right now. Stay away. Those big 70s earmuff ones. You know, somebody always will still kind of be like. I'm listening to a Dharma talk in loving kindness right now. Fucking leave me alone. Been there, done that, right? Yeah. So, you know, as much as we try to do these types of things, there's also what weaves together the satipatthana is that we're trying to recognize these experiences so that way we can, I almost think of them as like a four-speed car. You know, like where first gear is really slow, right? And the body is kind of slow. Like aging happens slowly. Breathing happens slowly. The second gear, vedana, is a little quicker. Noticing that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, that is changing. Third gear is a little faster. The emotional attitude, mind state, and thinking really fast. Right? Really, really fast. So a lot of times what we have to do when we feel, one of the best ways to use this is when you feel like you're worked up or you're struggling or you're suffering or you're just, you know, when you're in a bad spot, you can just kind of pause and be like, well, what am I paying attention to right now? What's happening right now? It's like, well, I'm thinking, controlling, fixing, trying to figure out. It's like, well, you're going too fast. You need to get back into the breath, get back into sound, get back into sensory experience, information that's coming in and the other senses. And how hard is it to adjust from thinking to breathing? It's a snip, if you can remember to do it. It's not difficult. You have to remember, that's where the remembering part comes in. You have to remember to recognize that that's an option in every single moment of your life. Which you hear, they go, yeah, of course, totally, got it, no problem. Well, I'll give it a shot tomorrow and see how it goes. Sometimes, you know, you'll find that you'll kind of get out of these, some of these experiences more quickly than you used to, and then that's usually when mindfulness practice starts to create an appetite for us. We're like, holy shit, this stuff's pretty helpful. And then the characteristics that we want to be able to see and that we start to see is that things have these qualities, all these experiences have these qualities of change, that they're always changing, the body's changing, the comfort of the body is changing, the emotions are changing, the thoughts are changing, the feelings are changing. Everything is changing. So it's not present time, it's not present moment, it's present movement. Well, right now I'm experiencing unpleasant anger. Well, that unpleasant anger is only going to stay as long as I'm clinging to it and trying to fix and control it. Right? So we recognize that impermanence is the term around here, anicca. All things rise and fall, all things change. the body changes much slower than the emotions change or the thoughts change. Right? You ever see those things on like the internet where they have like somebody take a picture of themselves once a year for like 20 years and they speed it up and you're like, wow, that's crazy. But that's how it works, right? It's slow, slow down. Be with experiences to be with change, that things are changing. When we recognize that things are changing, we don't get so upset when we're in the unpleasant, difficult experience, because we're like, well, this sucks right now, but, you know, I'll get through. It won't be like this forever. But when you're in that unpleasant, shitty experience, you ever think to yourself, this is just how it is, it's always like this. They're always like that, it's always like this, I'm always like this. And we create a view, and we cling to that view and perception that that's how it is, even though it's just how it is right now. And we want to be able to recognize that things change. And because things change, you have this this dukkha, that things are difficult and they're unsatisfying. Experience, it's in and of itself. Reality, this is where Buddhism gets its bad rap, unfortunately. Reality in and of itself is a little bit unsatisfying. Have you ever been dissatisfied by reality? Yeah, that's how that's how it is, isn't it? You know, that's actually, there's wisdom to recognize. So I call it the wisdom of dissatisfaction. It's like, yeah, because things are changing, there's dissatisfaction, that there's loss, there's disappointment, there's aggravation, because you can't, as soon as you get it all worked out, right, it changes. You know? You get everybody sat down at the table and the food comes out and you're just like, yeah. And then 30 minutes later, you're like, man, why did I eat so much? This is gross. This is like, oh. Who are these people? I go lay down now. And what happened? Things change. The conditions change and they're unsatisfying. So we want to be able to recognize that in these foundations of mindfulness, that these things are changing and that they're not going to provide, nothing is going to provide long-term, full-time satisfaction. So stop clinging to feelings and to attitudes and to mind states and to thoughts and to ideas. And of course, this is where it accumulates in this anatta, that these things are not self, which I think I talked on recently. I could talk on for a long time because it's a strange concept in Buddhism, this idea of anatta, not self. And if that you look in your experience, if you look at your body, are you your body? You're like, yeah, I'm my body. Are you your ear? Are you your nose? Are you your lips? Are you your tongue? Are you your chin? Are you your elbows? Which part of the body is you? All of it? But when we break it down, we're like, am I my cheeks? Am I my feet? Am I my clothes? We probably identify with our clothes and how we look and why we like our clothes. We're very identified by the body. Right? And especially here in Los Angeles, it's such an interesting place around image and how we look and how we feel. And so many people suffer about how their body, how the body is, how the body looks. Right? And are you that body? No, it's just a impermanent sensation. It's just a sensation. It's just a sight. It's just a smell. It's just an image. Are you your feelings? Are you the painful sensation in your knee? Are you the pleasant taste in your mouth? Is that you? No, none of it's you. All of it feels like it's you. We take it so personally. That's the problem. We take everything so personally. I'm this body. I'm this feeling. I'm this emotion. I feel sad, so I'm a sad person who's sad. And why am I sad? Because of all, now I have to have the drop-down menu of all the things in my life that didn't pan out and think about all of those and be like, well, I mean, I totally should be sad based on my experience in life so far. Nobody understands me, you know. And then we think about that and we create a narrative. We create a story about who we are. We create a self. I am this person who does these things, who feels this way, who is like this, and this is, and you're a person who's like that, and we separate. But if we look and we start to see, we start to break down the clinging and the over-identification with the body and the feelings and the emotions and the thoughts, and we just start to experience them as temporary, unsatisfying, selfless phenomena. Which is a little esoteric, but not really, actually. And so the more that we can kind of practice these things, the goal of mindfulness, of course, is to, the Buddha says that mindfulness practice is the direct path to liberation. So the reason why we do all these exercises is so we can understand where in the foundations and where in our experience we're creating suffering for ourselves, and therefore where can we intervene on the process to end suffering for ourselves. It's not just so we can feel the body or understand the breath. We're not doing this so we can get good at breathing, right? Sometimes we get tricked and we think that I'm not a very good breather. You ever think you ever be meditating? And I remember early on, I'd be like, I wonder if I'm breathing. I'd be like, I don't know if I'm breathing right. I'm like, I'd start thinking about breathing. It's just like, man, I could suffer about anything. I'm like, man, I'm a bad breather. I'm a bad sitter. Oh man, I just suck at everything. You know, it's like, wow. You know, where'd that come from? Well, that's part of my conditioning, right? Is that a feeling in that sense. So we look at these practices as a way to train. So we're trying to train our mind to pay attention or to recognize things in a particular way, so that way we can start to recognize when we are suffering, or we're having anxiety, or we're having fear or stress, suffering, another ambiguous term. There's lots of ways in which one can suffer. I'm sure you have your favorite top five. Right. Top five ways to suffer, right? Anxiety. I love me some anxiety. I love future tripping. It's my favorite thing. Right. Any future trippers out there? Ah, yeah. What about the past? Anybody totally obsessed with the past and trying to figure out where it all went wrong? Man, when was it, man? I was just like, I was so fucking happy in the 90s. You know, I had a good thing going. It was all working out for me. Where did it all go wrong? I must have just... Somewhere along the way, I got, you know, something happened. So we kind of try to do this, predict and control, predict and control, predict and control. You know, regret and blame and these types of strategies. So I think that's all I'm going to say about the foundations of mindfulness, because I want to hear what questions you might have. And I'm recording this for my buddy in Nashville, so let me stop it. Hi, Andrew.
I'll do it as soon as they give me my phone back.
There you go.